Okay, let's get started. So my name is Greg Boer. I'm a principal program manager on the Team Foundation server team, and I'm going to talk to you about our experience in shifting to an agile requirements model, specifically going to a continuous delivery cadence. Before I get started, I thought, well, maybe you want to know a little bit about who is this guy standing in front of you. So who is this guy? So let's start at the beginning. I was born in the United States, in Iowa. And more specifically, I was born in the northwest corner of Iowa, and even more specifically, I was born on a farm. I'm an Iowa farm boy by heart, actually. So I had about a mile square to play with when I was a kid. I learned how to drive one of these when I was five. I learned how to drive one of these when I was six. And I'm not kidding. My dad said, could you drive the car home from the field? And I said, all right, fine. And I got my first accident when I was nine, when I ran it into the barn. So that's my experience there. But I did grow up. I graduated from college. I went and I moved to Seattle about 25 years ago. And that's where I've been ever since. And this is my family. I am the proud father of three boys. The proud husband of a wife of 25 years. And don't let that nice smile fool you. She is very tough with those boys. They get away with nothing with her, that's for sure. And this past June, we added a girl to our family. My oldest son got married. Aw. All right, so that's enough of that. Okay. 8 years ago, I joined Microsoft. And I've been on the Visual Studio team ever since. I've been through three releases at Microsoft. All of them have been in Team Foundation Server. In the most recent release, 2012, we made a major transition, and that's really what I'm going to talk to you about in this talk. We went from an organization that shipped a box product once every 2 years. We were that. That's what we did. To an organization that ships to the cloud every 3 weeks, ships an update to our box product about every 3 months, and still tries to ship a box product about every, I don't know, we haven't done it yet. But I'm going to guess it's going to be less than 2 years. So that's our transition. And how that transition has affected us in a lot of ways. And I'm going to talk specifically how it affected us and how we deal with requirements. So I'm going to talk about three different ways that I think impacted what we did. The first one is how we engage our customers in this new world. What do we do with that? The second one is how do we engage the teams who are actually working on them? How do we engage them with requirements? And the last is how do we engage leadership? So I'm going to talk about each one of these things. So let's get started on customers. How do we engage our customers? Well, let's look at how we used to do it, shall we? How we used to do it is we had this two-year cycle and we started with a visioning phase, where we kind of envision what we want to do with this release. We figure out what are our major goals. We do a little bit of planning. We figure out, hey, this is the kind of stuff that we would do. And then we would hold what we called an SDR. Now, an SDR is a software design review. And let me tell you a little bit about what it is. A software design review is when we flew in about 12, 15 customers into the Microsoft campus. We brought them into a room and we showed them our plan. And the idea was we vetted the plan with the customers. We wanted to make sure that, hey, are we meeting real needs here with the customers? And it was a three-day thing, and we showed them our plan. And at the end, what we did is this dot voting exercise where we gave each customer like 10 dots, right? And they would vote on the features that were most important to them. And you kind of caught them. They were like trading dots with each other or making deals and stuff like that. But that was kind of our idea. Like, we wanted to get the customers involved. And it worked, you know, it was good, but let's dissect it a little bit. First of all, you have 14 customers from all over the world. There's always going to be a more vocal corner of the room, right? And if there's one thing I've learned in talking to customers, that the person who talks the loudest isn't necessarily the person you should be listening to, right? It was really a collaboration facilitation challenge to do that. You wanted to show respect to everybody and let everybody get their word in edgewise, but it was very hard to just cut people off and say, look, you need to stop talking because we have to listen to this person, right? The next thing, if you look at this part right here, every single line item you saw there was a presentation we made to the customer. It was 3 days of grueling presentation, time after time. Some features were allotted 15 minutes to set up their feature, describe it, describe the value props, have a discussion. It was a long, grueling process, if you think about it. And you don't have to know much about how the brain works to understand that there's a certain capacity you reach, a diminishing return where there's just not much value, right? And I think this person kind of sums up how a lot of people were feeling at the end. It was just a lot to take in. Now, regardless of whether this model worked or not, right, it just doesn't scale. If you're releasing stuff every 3 weeks, you don't have time to have this time where you bring in a bunch of people, even if you have the resources to do it, and a lot of people don't. So we had to change how we did things. So I want to talk about that. How many have seen this YouTube video out there on YouTube? Yeah? Okay. It's this computer animated video is done by a consulting company, and it's a story about this agile manager, and what he's trying so hard to do is run an agile project inside a bureaucratic, you know, organization with lots of things. And here he is, he's talking to the customer. And he's explaining to the customer, look, I need you involved in the project on a daily basis. That's how we can deliver the best results. And the customer is saying, but I'm a very important person. I'm very busy. I don't have time to spend with you on that. And the story, as it goes, is actually a tragedy by all respects, because he goes through all the work. He tries, he cuts through all the bureaucratic red tape. He finally gets something quickly to the customer, and the customer looks at it and says, but that's not what I wanted, right? So the kind of the point of the story is you feel bad for the guy, you know, and how hard it is to do this in an organization like this. But I think it really does miss one simple truth, and that customers have day jobs, right? They don't have time to spend with you on a daily basis. And as nice as it would be if they could, they don't. They have their own problems that they have to deal with, right? And for you to just assume they can be a part of your project is kind of disrespectful in a way. And what if your customers are external? What if you have thousands of customers? What do you do then? Like, you can't get them involved in a daily basis. So what do we do? What do we do to get these people engaged in our project so we can enjoy, you know, enjoy the feedback that they give us? What can we do? So I'll talk about that. I want to talk about this first. This is a book I read recently called Switch. How many have read this book? Okay, a number. I highly recommend this book. It's subtitled How to Change Things When Change is Hard, and it talks about how to change things when the way things are so embedded in people's culture, people's minds. And what they talk about in this book is the concept. They talk about many things. I'm going to talk about one concept out of the book called the rider and the elephant. So let me describe this a little bit. What they say is your brain actually works on two different subsystems all the time. They're working all the time, right? There is the analytical part of your brain. That's the rider. That part of your brain is analytical. It's the thinker. It's the one that exercises self-control. It's the one that understands, like, hey, if you want to lose weight, you need to lay off the cookies once in a while. Like, it understands that part. It's the one that's analytical. It can sometimes get bogged down in analytics. That's the rider. That's the thinking part of your brain. And then there's this other part of your brain that they call the elephant. And that's the emotional part. That's the passionate part. That's the one that just thinks from the heart. That's the one that likes rewards. That's the one that wants the cookie. That's the one that, you deserve a cookie. I'm going to have that damn cookie. Like, it's my cookie. That's the elephant part of your brain talking, right? It's also the one that's extremely loyal. It's the one that looks at someone, and if they know that they need help, they will jump to action to help that person. That's the elephant part. So they talk about this as the rider part of your brain is like a 150-pound man sitting on top of a 6-ton elephant. The rider can get the elephant to go in a certain direction up to a point. You can have self-control. You can get teams to do something up to a point. But at some point, emotion takes over, and that elephant will go wherever it wants to go. And so what they say is, when people have tried to get things to change, they've so often spoken to the rider. They come up with all the logical reasons why things should change. They come up with all the reasons, the data, the analysis of why things can change. And really, the, The rider doesn't argue at all, but they do very little to motivate the elephant part of us, to get people emotionally engaged. And that's what we need to do. If we're dealing with customers who have day jobs, if we're in this situation where I need your help, but the customer is very busy, how can you get that customer emotionally engaged in your project? That's what I'm going to try to talk. I have a few practices I'm going to go through that we do now that I think do that. I think they do a pretty good job. Here's the first one. Site visits. Site visits are something that we do, and I think we do them pretty well. And what we do is we get half a dozen people from different parts of the product team, and we gather them up, we fly out to the customer site, and we just spend a day with them. Most of the time, we're just watching them. A lot of times, we just watch their meetings, how they interact. We get some interviews with people where people just sit and they talk to us. We videotape them, all that kind of stuff. And now let's compare this, right? Let's compare this to the SDR. The SDR, we say, you come to us. You give up your time. You give up your 3 days of work and come to us, right? And we will get the information. Here we're saying we're going to give up our time and we're going to go on your site and watch you. We are saying you are a valuable resource. You are important to us. We need your help. One of the videos that came out of this was a guy who was being interviewed, and he was just passionately bashing the Microsoft tool stack. Like, he could not say enough things that he was having problems with it. And that video came back to the product group, and the thing went viral, went in the product group. Like, it went all over the place, because you got this raw, visceral kind of engagement from the customer who's saying exactly how they feel about the product and what would make it better. And you see the pain, right? You see it on their face. I think that's one wonderful thing about the site visits. Here's another thing. We have customer visits. We have people who... And you would be surprised how many customers are willing to take time off of their day, come to your project, and just talk to you because you're saying, look, you have the stage. We want to listen to you. You talk to us about whatever you want. You're running the show. And today, with technology, like with Link or GoToMeeting or Skype, it's not that expensive to do these kinds of things. You can pipe them in, put a screen on the wall, and you can have them have the stage that way. It doesn't even take that much, but it gives them an opportunity to be valued. You're telling them how valuable they are. Here's something that I did new in the last product release. I created these customer councils. Now, customer councils are people that are deeply invested in a certain area of a problem space, a domain space, and also invested in your product. So for an example, I did the Agile project management tooling on TFS. I found some people who were deeply invested in Agile and Agile management, and also deeply invested in our tools. And these are the people who passionately wanted to make our tool set better to solve this particular problem. And they were from all over the world, and we met every 2 to 3 weeks on Link for an hour. And every time I came and I said, look, this is what I think the problem space is. This is what I think I'm going to do. What do you think? Tell me what you think. Help me understand. Is this meeting your need? And these things were incredibly valuable because you could go very deep on a certain topic and you could hear from a broad range of people. I have not done entire features because of this. I had this one feature that I showed to them and I said, hey, this is what it can do and this is what we're going to do. And they all go, okay, that's good. And I said, so how many of you would use this to solve a real business problem you have? No one. None of them. So I didn't do the feature, as you might guess, right? It saved our team a whole bunch of time. And there are whole features that we did. There was one particular feature in how we calculated capacity in sprint planning that we weren't going to finish it in a certain way, but one of the people on the team who explained to us in his beautiful German precision how stupid it was the way we were doing it, right? He said, look, if I'm going to take this to my colleagues, they would look like you can't do math. Like you can't do it right. Like you don't even understand how management works. So we need to fix this, and we did. And this was a huge valuable resource. And these are the kinds of things that you can set up pretty easily. And these, what I found is that people are very excited to be a part of something like this because they want to be part of something bigger than them. Here's what I'd call our inner circle. Internally, we call it our champs list. These are the people who are passionate about your product. These are the people that are out there trying to make it, are championing your product out there. These are the most passionate, opinionated set of elephants that you ever met, right? Like, they are your biggest fans, but they're your strongest critic at the same time. They're the people out there putting their necks on the line trying to champion the product in an org out there. They're the ones who are going to give you that kind of feedback. I'm sure that all of you can come up with customers or people who are like that, right? They're the people who are really trying to champion your product out there. How can we tap into this? And then we've been able to do this. We have an email list where all these people are on. They're emailing each other all the time, say, hey, I have this problem. How can we solve it? And they're answering each other's questions. They're emailing us. They're saying, hey, I got this problem, or we really need to fix this. This is what we need to do. And we email them. We send an email out. If we want to do something that's different to the product, maybe slightly disruptive in what it's doing, like how it's acting, we would send it out to them and say, hey, we're thinking about doing this. What problems could you see? Huge, huge, rich information that we have there right on our fingertips, right from an email. And then I can't not talk about user voice, right? Or the social networking things, Twitter and blogging and Facebook and stuff like that. That's just the age that we're in. I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but I'm going to give two examples. I think representative examples. If you're looking for an example of a blog that I think is a good example of a blog that engages customers, I think you can just look at Brian Harry's blog. And I'm not saying that because the guy's my boss, because he is, full disclosure. But I think you look at it and you see not only is it a rich source of information and not only the good polished stuff, like he shares some of our dirty secrets as well, transparent information to the customer, it's also, he is very good about responding to comments on the blog posts. He stays engaged with them. And I would say for myself, twice a week, I'll get looped into a conversation with a customer through email that often evolves into a phone call and a meeting because of a conversation that started on the blog post. And that gives me a wonderful opportunity. Some of those people have ended up being on my customer council. Some of those people have ended up helping me in other ways. It's given us the ability to stay involved and engaged with the customer. Another example I want to just give is Twitter. I didn't have to look very far, but here what you'll see is a bunch of tweets. This was last week. The service was down. In fact, the service was down this morning, I guess, so everyone was freaking out on Twitter and in our internal email as well. Not a good week to have your service go down on the ALM Summit. But okay, so last week, our service was down. And you get all these tweets, hey, the service down, what's up? You know, not a good time for my service to be down, all that kind of stuff. Immediately you have Buck, who's one of our Twitter champions. He says, hey, the service is down, we're working on it, want to let you know. And then he follows up with a personalized at reply to every single person who reported it. Say, hey, I just want to let you know we're working on it. Just want to let you know we're working on it, right? Then when the service comes up, he posts, hey, look, it's back up again. And then you have people saying thank you. Like, thank you for your hard work. Thank you for getting it up so quickly. Thank you for doing all that kind of stuff. Like, that's the kind of engagement. And now you have relationships with customers that you could turn into an email exchange, that could graduate to a phone call or something like that. So if we go in this new world and we're saying, hey, we're having site visits and customer visits just always, forever, every couple of months. We're having customer councils that are meeting every couple of weeks, and they're happening, several of them, each in several different domains. We have an inner circle that's active all day long, and Twitter that's active all day long. I would say that because we had to support this continuous delivery cadence, we are better at engaging our customers than we were before. And I think we thought we were pretty good before. But I say, like, now we're never not engaged with the customer. We have this continuous stream of activity with them. Okay? All right. So that's the first one. Let's talk about the second thing, engaging your team. So in the old world, this is what it looked like for us. In the old world, we did the visioning and the planning. Then there was a coding phase for us. And then the coding phase, there was a stabilization phase where there was no more features and everyone just had to fix bugs and bring it back down to earth, make sure the quality was good and so forth. And then there's what we called escrow, which essentially was a code freeze, right? It's like no code changes were made. It was only the most egregious bugs were fixed during this time. And then you wonder, hey, what does the software teams do during the vision and planning stage? Well, what we had was this milestone queue, we called it, where everyone worked on process improvements kinds of things. And you look at this and you say, there's really a relatively small part of the cycle where the teams are innovating and creating and building new things. And the rest of it is just kind of meh. It's not fun stuff. It's mostly just drudgery, if you think about it. And regardless of what you think about it, it just doesn't scale. You just can't do that when you're here. There's not the opportunity to engage the team in that way. You have to find a way to keep them continuously engaged. How many people have heard of Atlassian? Raise your hand. Okay, a lot of people. I've heard of Atlassian. Obviously, there are competitors, and I watch them closely. They're a strong competitor. I respect them. How many people have heard of their FedEx days? Okay, a few less people. So what Atlassian did is they said, hey, we're going to do this day where for the next 24 hours, you can work on whatever you want. Forget what you have to do, forget your commitments, all that kind of stuff. For the next 24 hours, you get to work on whatever you want. And it has to be done in 24 hours, hence the name has to be done overnight, hence the name FedEx. And they would do it, and people would do it, come up with their ideas and work on whatever they would. They would refactor those code, they would fix the bugs that they wanted to do, whatever they wanted to do, and then they would have a voting, and there would be prizes, and there'd be a party. And what they found out is that the productivity in that 24-hour period was so big, like, why are we only doing this once a year? So they decided to do it once every couple of months, right? And then they decided to say, well, let's give people a certain percentage of their time where they can do whatever they want, because they got so much productivity out of that. And we've done some hackathons in our own company, and we saw the same kind of thing. You see amazing productivity in a 24-hour period. And I believe what we see when we do that is we're seeing what is motivating the elephant of the team. This is the stuff, like what they're working on in that period is the stuff that they're passionate about. It also gives us a glimpse of the power of an emotionally motivated team, of what they could actually pull off. Let me give you another example. How many people have been this person? You're talking to the team and say, could you please do this feature? Like, I really, really need this feature done. Can we please get it done? And the team doesn't want to. Like, maybe their writer understands intellectually why it has to be done. But in the particular example that I'm thinking of, the team had to do a lot of painful refactoring to implement the feature. They had to refactor the tests. It was like they just didn't want to do the feature. How many have been in a situation like that where you feel that way, right? Okay, so the team doesn't want to, it's not engaged, right? And it's kind of like dragging an elephant along behind you, like trying to pull them in a certain direction. Then what I did is I asked a customer to come to the team. And I had the customer talk to them and explain to them the pain they were feeling and what was actually causing the problem and what the repercussions were. And what the team saw was a human being with pain, and the emotional aspect kicked in, and they wanted to help that person. They wanted to go fix the problem. And then what we had was one guy worked the weekend refactoring all the code so that the feature could be done, right? We went from this to that, and all we did was motivate the elephant. All we did was get them emotionally engaged in what they wanted to do. And what I'm saying is that if you want to be on this continuous delivery cadence, you need your team invested in what you're doing, because you don't have time to be dragging an elephant behind you. The elephant needs to be charging along with you. So let's talk about that a little bit. I think one of the big things is get them connected with the customer. Not all the time, but send them on the site visits. Take a couple of the team members, send them to a site visit. And if you're asking yourself, well, is that worth it? Like, they are sitting there, is it worth it to take this person 2 days out of their work and send them down to the customer? Can't they just read the trip report? I would just say, ask yourself, what's the difference in productivity between a team who's not emotionally motivated to do your project and a team that is? And then answer the question. Can we afford to send a person? Can we not afford to get people engaged in seeing the customer? Customer visits, obviously. Customer councils. For the customer councils I did, all of mine were on link. And I invited the team to silently participate on the call. So I was running the call and talking with the customer, but they were all listening in. And about every time, about half, three-quarters of the team actually linked, listened in and listened. And they were engaged because on the side, they were IMing me like crazy. Like, hey, ask them this question. Tell me, what did they think about this? All this. Ask me this stuff, right? And then we'd all go out to lunch together afterwards, and we'd talk about it. And now the team's like, they're excited. They see these people, and they want to solve their problem. And with the inner circle and the social media, like, just forward them. I take many opportunities to forward example tweets, example emails to people, and really what I'm trying to do is this. I want them to feel the pain of the customer. I want them to know human beings that have this pain, but we can't stop there because oftentimes a team is always focused on the undone backlog, right? They need to see the joy, right? They need to see how customers love what they're doing. They need to know that what they did is matters, that it is they want to be a part of something bigger than them, and they want to know that all the work they did is actually matter. It doesn't matter. I know that we have stuff to do, but look at all the amazing things that you've done. That's what engages a team. Here's another thing that we've done. So continuous grooming. I want to talk about this. Let's say we go here, and this is our three-week cycle, with a diamond being every one of the sprints, and then on the beginning of the sprint, you have this sprint planning, if you will, right? I believe that what has happened, at least what has happened in our organization, and I've talked to others who've, other people who've had the same thing happen there, is that people interpret the Agile Manifesto is that you don't spec, you don't document. On the day of sprint planning, you bring a set of user stories to the team. That's pretty much the first time they may have seen them. You review the acceptance criteria, you estimate them, and you go on the sprint, right? And I think, I ask, how can you get a team emotionally engaged in doing something when the first time they've seen it is the same hour that they're being asked to estimate the thing? It's very difficult. It could work with certain basic things, right? But if you want to do something disruptive, or if you want to do something that's groundbreaking or innovative, you can't do it that way. It just doesn't work. The human mind doesn't work that way. And so we started implementing this idea of what we called were grooming meetings. And these were standing meetings on the calendar, same day every week. For an hour, the team got together. And what the product owner did, what I did, is I brought to the team, hey, this is the stuff that we're going to be doing in the next couple of sprints. This is the kind of things we're going to be doing. And my goal was, by the time they got to the sprint planning, they've seen it at least 2 times. They've been through the design, the goals, what we want to accomplish, at least 2 different times. So that they can, and my goal was there, was to get them emotionally engaged in this. Now I want to tell a story that makes the point of this in a backwards way. Not everyone liked these grooming meetings. There was actually some pressure from management that they were wasteful. Why? That's a very expensive meeting to pull the entire team together for 1 hour. Like, have you calculated the cost of a meeting like that? Like, do you really, really need to do that? Then what happened is people started to hear grumblings from the development team that they didn't like this new Scrum model very well. Some of them actively hated the sprints. And when they started to dig a little bit deeper, they found the reason they hated it is because they felt they have no control over their destiny. They show up at the sprint planning meeting. They see the stories for the first time. They're expected to estimate and just work on the marching orders and get it done. And they had no opportunity to influence the product. And it's very hard to get emotionally engaged in especially a difficult project if you don't have any influence over it. Except for the developers on teams that were doing grooming meetings. They were happy. They felt they had the opportunity to influence the product. And the thing is that's it. Like, if you're doing these things, you're not only getting them emotionally engaged, that if you have a customer that, if you have a team, rather, that is engaged with the customer and understands what the customer's pains are and has and in getting engaged in the problem that you're trying to solve, they help you come up with a better solution. You have a lot of very smart people there that can give you offer you suggestions. I've had developers say, look, I can do pretty much everything you want, not quite the same way, for about 30% of the cost. Like, is that okay? And I'm like, yeah. And he could offer that suggestion because he understood the problem space and he was able to get emotionally engaged into it. So I highly recommend this as some sort of a practice of allowing the team to know what's coming so they have an opportunity to be involved in the whole process. And I really don't think you can talk about agile requirements and engagement with the team without talking about a spec. Now, a spec kind of has gotten a bad rep, right, in the new agile world, and I understand why. I was the reason why. In the old world, when you had this long cycle, I was very good at writing detailed specs. I documented all the business logic, all the information logic. I documented the screen interactions. And I did this because I felt it was the way to make the team successful. But things have changed, largely in two ways in how we deal with specs now. One, I make sure that I dedicate a good chunk of my spec to motivating the elephant. Every one of my specs starts with a storyboard. And the purpose of the storyboard is to lay out to the team, this is what we're going to build. I want you to envision the end result here. See what we're going to do, the goodness that's going to come out of this. I make sure that I have a very good storyboard that tells it. The second thing that I've changed a lot is I've learned to invest a lot more in tribal knowledge and rely on it. So that I'm engaging the team on a continual basis. I'm investing in a tribal knowledge of how this whole problem space is and what we're going to solve, that if you invest in that, you don't have to put as much detail in the spec anymore because it becomes socialized into the team. And then you can, then the spec is a team artifact. You put in the spec exactly what the team wants. The team, the spec is to help the team succeed and nothing more. So this is what I do. Whatever the team wants in the spec, I put in there. If they don't need it in there, I don't. As long as I trust them. I get to the point where I trust them and I spend a whole lot less time writing down a lot more details than I did before. And we're more successful than before. Okay, all right. So that's the spec, that's the thing, and now we're going to end with the last part, engaging leadership, okay? All right, now we have these people at the top, what do we do? Let's talk about how it was in the old world. So in what would happen in the old world is that we get a release plan. This was a kind of a tablets from the mountain would come down to the team, and leadership would say, this is what we're going to do. And we were asked to come up with a plan to complete it by the end of our coding cycle. One time it was like we were told, like, I want you to go and break down every, estimate every task, break it down to nothing more than 8 hours of tasks for the next, and it was going to be like 4 or 5 months to ensure that we're going to get this all done. It was a pretty crazy experience, actually. If you look, looking back, I think that was pretty crazy. Like, there's no way we know what tasks we're going to do 6 months from now, right? But that was kind of how it was. We had this one release plan. The coding, we had coding milestones that were 12 weeks. At the beginning of the coding milestone, we reported to leadership what we committed what we would do. And at the end of the milestone, we were held accountable to what we did. And then in the last part, there was this stabilization phase where it's very much about bugs and compliance or exit criteria. And here, what we have is, if you look at this, this is very much a command and control model. Because leadership saw this as a great big ship. And the release plan was like telling the ship, getting the whole ship to go into the right direction, right? And then the coding was about making sure the ship was doing the right thing, it was going out to sea. And the stabilization phase was all about turning the ship back around, the whole big, huge ship back around and bringing it back to port again so you could release. And the only way we knew how to do that was by this has this strict command and control kind of interaction. But if you look at the new way, it simply does not scale. It can't. And in fact, it's even worse than the picture describes. Imagine 20 of these lines going, 20 different teams each releasing to the service individually, releasing to the service every 3 weeks. That's where we're at today. You have all these different teams making their own decisions about releasing to the service. There's no way that you can have some sort of command and control interaction anymore. It just doesn't work. And this is where I'm going to make a call out to a talk that's coming up in on Thursday. My colleague Aaron Bjork is going to be doing a talk about how we manage teams in the enterprise, you know, from a leadership level. And he talks about some very good practices that I think we've come up with that make the interaction with leadership lightweight and flexible and keeps up with all of these teams running like this. So I highly recommend that. I'm not going to talk about practices. I'm going to talk about three principles and how we've changed our view on them. The first one is transparency. We all want transparency, right? Leadership always wants transparency. They want to know what's going on. As a parent, I wanted transparency. I wanted to know what was going on in my kid's life. There was one time my son, teenage son, came home. He went out with some friends one night. The next morning, I'm talking to him and say, hey, what did you do last night? And he said, well, you know, I hung out with some friends, you know, and we were all doing some stuff and watching TV. And then a couple of the friends, they went outside and they smoked some pot. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, they smoke pot? Like, what's going on? Like, what kind of friends are these? What can you do? I said, what if they would have offered it to you? And he goes, well, they did. What? They offered it to you? Like, what's going on here? Like, I don't know. And then my son, and I'm so glad he did, he said, Dad, if you want, he said no, by the way, just so everyone knows. So he said, Dad, if you want me to tell you about what goes on, you're going to have to not freak out. Right? That's what he said. Like, listen, or I'm just going to tell you the stuff that I think you can handle. And he was right. Like, I had to not freak out. I had to trust him, right? And that's the way it is with transparency. We want transparency, but we have to ask ourselves, do we really want to know what goes on in the glass house? Do we really want to know all the dirty details that go on a software team? Because it's messy sometimes. You're dealing with performance issues with people. You're dealing with just blatant mistakes that people have made that they're trying to fix. You're dealing with problems of interactions between two team members. Do you really want that? Or are you just going to freak out? That's the thing we need to ask ourselves. Because if there is not safety in transparency, then it's going to become more formal. We're going to button it up. We're going to clean it up. And one thing that I believe is formality is waste. Anytime you have an interaction that you have to formalize it, you have to clean it up, that you have to tidy it, that's waste. That's waste on the giver's part. That's waste on the receiver's part. And formality is caused by two things, I believe. Fear, I don't know what's going to happen, or infrequency. It doesn't happen very often. If the only time there's interaction between the teams and the leaders is every 12 weeks when they report up their status, you're going to get more formality. If you can move to an model where you can more frequently interact, then you can not have to pay that waste so much. So that's transparency. Let's talk about traceability. Traceability is, it's a good thing. Our tool does this. This is actually a screenshot from our tool where we trace the stories to the bugs and the tasks and so forth. And in short, what traceability is I have this thing and I want to get it done. And I want to know all the things that are attached to it that contribute to it getting done. And I want to have I want to view how all that's coming together, right? Traceability is still used, but it's changed for us, I think, in a couple of ways. One is that any traceability that was manually maintained was abandoned. Because we're moving so fast, we did not have the time to manually maintain the traceability anymore. So it really put a pressure on the importance of tools to automatically generate the traceability that we needed. The second thing is traceability used to be much more of a command and control, compliance enforcement kind of thing from top down. Did you complete all your localization, your performance, your security requirements, all that kind of stuff? What it has turned into is much more of a tool by the team. The team uses it to make a decision. And I think that's appropriate. Because I have the story where, like, I had a wonderful looking traceability chart. All the tasks were closed. All the bugs had been fixed and verified. All the tests were green. And then I asked that tester, you know, that one tester, that tester you could put on anything, right? That awesome tester. I said, could you just go play with it for a couple hours? And they find 20 bugs, right? So who do you trust? Do you trust the traceability chart? Because it can lull you into a sense of comfort. Or do you trust the team members? And the answer is, you need both. It's a tool to the team to make the decision. You have to rely on the team. And that leads me to my last point. My last point is trust. And quite frankly, if you want to move to this continuous delivery model, what has to happen is leadership needs to trust the team to deliver. They have to. There's no option around it. You need to trust the team to make the decision to push it out production, because there's no way you can insert yourself to verify that it's all going to be done. The other aspect of this, which I think is just as important, the team needs to learn to trust themselves. See, the teams in our organization didn't have the safety net of the stabilization phase to save them later. They didn't have the safety net of all the command and control procedures that were going to come later to make sure they did it. They were responsible now. And when we were first starting to release on a 3-week cadence, and it was about the second or third release in, what happened is that there were, like, I don't know, a dozen or so teams all checking into the branch that was going to be pushed to production. And there's this week of verification where they do a sanity test to make sure everything's good before they turn on the switch, right? Like, and the idea is you should never find any bugs here because you should have verified it all ahead of time. One of the teams checked in some code that basically destabilized the whole system. So we couldn't release that time. We couldn't do it. And I would say that the response of our leadership was exactly right. They said, this is unacceptable. This cannot happen. I know that, you know what, our customers are used to us shipping every 2 years and we're giving them stuff every 3 weeks and they're probably ecstatic. They don't even care if they're waiting another 3 weeks to release it. I know that we have another release that we can do, but the fact is we have to know that every release is going to go out the door. So I don't know what we have to do, but we have to figure out what went wrong and make sure it doesn't happen again. And I'll tell you, that moment was like a moment in truth, and that moment did more for teams to be held accountable than all the command and control procedures in the world, right? Because teams knew that they were responsible, and if they messed up, it affected everyone else, all of their colleagues. And we haven't missed one yet since then. So trust, I cannot stress this enough. Trust is so important when you're moving to this continuous delivery model. And the fact is that lack of trust, you know, that big powerful beast, that elephant that can get so much done and everything like that, lack of trust is like putting shackles on that thing. Lack of trust is like just chaining down your most valuable potential resource of energy. And just saying, look, I don't trust you, you're just going to do that. And that's why I think it is so important. If you're going to be moving to this model, you need to understand you need to trust. Okay? All right. Now I'm finished. These are the three things that I talked about. And I think that we have gotten out to a much better place in how we engage our customers, the team, and our leadership. And that's all I have to say. So thank you very much for your time. So what time is it? Is there time for questions at all?
1 minute.
1 minute for questions? Okay. Any questions? Yes.
So since you're releasing every 3 months and, you know, out to the general public and every 3 weeks to
Will there ever be another boxed release? Yeah, so the question is, so you're treading on some thin ice for me. Like, you know, I'm just a product guy, right? So I don't know if you're trying to sneak some information out of me or not. So the answer is that I think we plan to also have a major release as well. So, but I don't know when. Well, I lie. I kind of know when, but I'm not going to say it. So, right? Okay. Now, I am not answering that. I'm sorry. Any other questions? Do I see it? Any?
Do you have any kind of documentation of your requirements?
Do I have any kind of documentation of my requirements? So are you talking like the spec? Okay, so my requirements are basically in two forms. I have a backlog, which we store in TFS, and then all my specs are PowerPoints. Now, I have a PowerPoint where I have a storyboard to motivate the elephant, to lay out the picture of this is the vision, and then I have slides that lay out the details, and it's just the details that they want.
What do you do when you have a change to the requirement?
Sure, when I have a change to the requirement, if there's a change to the requirement within the sprint?
No, you have the screen, you have the buttons, you have a storyboard, and you need to change it.
And I need to change it. After the team has decided to start working on it.
After it's done.
Yeah. Oh, it's a new spec. But the specs are much easier to create for me. Like I don't, and this is where some companies may have certain compliance requirements that they have to trace every change through something, and I don't have that. So I don't have an answer that I do with that. For me, I just create another spec. So there's a spec for every sprint. I pull it all together into one deck, and then that's what the team works on in that sprint. So, yeah. Okay, yes, back there. Yeah. So, okay, so a spec has been committed to by the team, and now we need to change it somehow, right?
Yeah, let's say you give a spec. If it's a storyboard, normally we're breaking down a bunch of stories. Mm-hmm. So you have the spec, you've created, let's say, 10 stories.
Right.
3 of them are committed and actually in the reaper. 2 of them are in progress. 5 of them are still in the backlog.
Right.
If they're still in the backlog, ignore them because they haven't been done anything.
Correct. Yeah, so the ones that are in progress, I will say that that happens all the time. Like the spec is being tweaked all throughout the sprint, actually. And in fact, it's being influenced by the team itself. They are saying, like, look, it's going to be a lot easier if we can do it this way. And it's a discussion. And actually, oftentimes, the team is updating the spec in the middle of the sprint. Like we have a discussion, and I say, hey, do you want to just go update it to what? Like, I don't care so much about this. You just update it to whatever you think would be the simplest implement. Like, go ahead, go for it. The spec belongs to the team. For the stuff that's been committed to, it's just a matter of like, I don't have a methodology to do that other than I make sure all the stakeholders are in the loop. The advantage of having my specs in a PowerPoint form is they're much easier to share with your stakeholders and your customers. They can just flip through it and see the storyboard. And it really, most of the time, they get the detail out of the storyboard. That's how I handle it. I'm not sure if that's an answer to your question, but that's how we deal with it.
I'm just thinking about in a high, you know, it's not necessarily your case, but in a highly regulated environment, you change something that's in progress, you will cause an impact.
Sure.
And, you know, changing the PowerPoint, my question would be, okay, which stories are going to be impacted? Because you go to TFS, how do you find the PowerPoint? More importantly, how do you find the stories that trace to the PowerPoint?
Yeah, so there's a wee link. I'll say, like, for us, the work items in TFS are linked to the spec on SharePoint. So you can go there and you can find exactly where the spec is.
From
so,
TFS
yes.
to SharePoint.
Yeah.
But if you go to SharePoint and pick a document, can you see the stories?
Well, I put the work item name inside the PowerPoint.
Okay, so you've got to go
and an ID. So there's that kind of a traceability two ways. Yeah. I think I'm done, so I got to go. But anybody who wants to come up and talk, that's just fine. So thank you very much.